Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two lovely sponsors this week. Lynda.com, that's L-Y-N-D-A.com, a huge learning resource on the web. You get 7 free days. You can try their entire learning library for free if you go to lynda.com/shoptalk and sign up there, including my course there on WordPress theming. And Environments for Humans promoting their Artifact Conf. That's literally the URL, artifactconf.com. It's coming to Austin here pretty darn quick, so we'll tell you more about both those things later in the show. But for now, let's kick things off.
Shopomaniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front-end web design and development. We are here live in the Google Hangouts studio, the Shop Talk Studios. How about that?
We are here. How about that?
Why is it just us today, Chris?
How's it going, Dave?
It's going pretty good.
I don't know. It's unusual. It's rare. It's fun. It's unusual. It's you guys know these things. We had one last week. It's a special rapid fire episode.
Gotcha.
That's right, everybody. No guests, no drama. Just all question on answer action. Let's just do it.
Let's hop in to the first question. It's an audio question. I should have had it queued up. And it comes from Paul Beijang. Yes, I'm going to call it that. Here we go.
Hi, Chris. Hey, Dave. While there isn't a way to comment on the past shows, I just wanted to add some information to the question. How do you integrate GitHub into a real web publishing workflow from Rapid Fire Episode 7? But I don't know where to comment. So my advice is to use PHP Storm, a very neat IDE for web development. Supports deploying Git commits also to a remote server like FTP or SFTP. I'm using that solution to commit and update a live server in my workflow. And I really like that solution. Cheers from Germany, Paul.
So, Paul, apologies for not getting to your question. It sounds like it was from a long time ago, but he's asking how to comment on the episodes. We have integrated commenting site-wide, so
yeah,
that's good.
We didn't always have that, though. That we have discussed on the things now, so you can participate in the thing. I put this at the top just as we have talked about this a number of times on the show, the idea of how do you work with Git or whatever and your normal workflow and have deployment. And deployment is like something generally that integrates with FTP so that you can get those files from wherever it is onto your live server. And we don't talk about IDEs very much, but Paul here likes PHP Storm, which is it's basically a web editor. You would use it instead of something like Sublime Text or whatever, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think PHP Storm is that. And so it sounds like it has all this kind of built in and under the hood. My question is, doesn't Coda have something similar? Am I crazy?
No, Coda is just, you can barely, that's kind of the whole point of working with it, right? Is that it's FTP is integrated and you open the files right from your web server. And when you hit save, it just saves it right back to your web server. Like a web dev kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is cool and okay. It just that means that you're not using Git really. And it does have some kind of Git thing in it too. So maybe it saves right to the server and you can also git commit to it or does that automatically somehow. I'm actually not sure how well Coda works with Git. I guess I should look into that. But Paul was like, just to get back to Paul's kind of comment is that I wonder if there's a lot of people using IDEs out there still, or what's the deal with not using them? It kind of seems like interesting to me. Like, wouldn't it be neat if, because I think what they kind of do is like execute your code and find errors in a little bit. So if you're writing PHP, it's not just like syntactically, heuristically looking at your code and seeing, oh, I see you missed a semicolon here. It's like actually executing it and being like, this triggered an error. PHP doesn't like this code, and PHP is telling you that it's a problem. So that's kind of, isn't that nice to have that in an editor? Why does like nobody use those anymore? Or maybe they do, and I'm just not in my world.
You know, maybe it's just not in our world. I mean, you know, Java people use Eclipse a lot, and that's got all those Java kind of features. .NET people use.
Is there a Ruby one?
Not really. I mean, TextMate was kind of the big Ruby, you know. A lot of people behind TextMate loved Ruby or whatever. But, you know, .NET uses Visual Studio for the most part. So, and I think it's, like, possible to write it without it. Obviously, it's just text files, but it's not beneficial. It does. It's sort of like you're missing out on half the language if you use the wrong code editor, which maybe PHP Storm and stuff like that is very,
and PHP Storm goes beyond that and even has FTP stuff.
Yeah, exactly, which is like necessary for your PHP workflow. Huh. I've never used it. I'm interested. Yeah. I probably won't start using it just because I have a workflow I really enjoy, but it's interesting to think about kind of an all-in-one.
I don't know. That's why I put it at the top. It's just kind of more of a comment than a question. Just kind of like, maybe we should investigate this a little, or maybe somebody will write in and tell us all about how awesome IDEs are or whatever. Yeah. Chris Grabinski writes in, I find typography on the web always looking somehow chunky. That's why I use the WebKit prefixed font smoothing anti-aliased on every project I work with to make it look nice and crisp, at least for some users. I rarely stumble upon websites that use this awesome CSS property in the wild, though yours, for example, doesn't use it either. Is there a major problem with this feature that I've missed, or any good reason why developers don't or shouldn't use it?
Oh, interesting.
Literally, WebKit font smoothing, anti-aliased. Chris just likes the way it looks all the time.
I'm personally not a fan of adjusting it. I know that people do that, but I feel like when you adjust it in one, it's going to mess up in another one. And Chrome has historically been the worst about it. I think it's getting better, like as of like this week or whatever. But Chrome, if you like do it just to make it look good on your Mac, it like you totally ruined it and made it illegible on your PC on Chrome for PC and stuff like that. So
that's exactly what I would be scared of.
I tend not to
mess.
Is
that it has unintended.
And if you bought a big fancy screen with like, you know, Retina and subpixels and everything, you probably want the subpixel anti-aliasing, in my opinion.
I just saw a site earlier today that used like a Helvetica new thin or light or whatever. So it was really light anyway and had this, and it was so light. It was like ghost weird. It was like too light, you know. Actually, I was just on a website now. I popped open the console and just threw in a style, you know, star, this universal selector, and then threw it on the page. And man, does it make a big difference. At least, of course, I'm in Chrome on Mac, so. Mm. It happens to be supported there and do something. On like some headline-y stuff, I think it looks a little nicer. And then on body copy, I'm a little ambivalent, I guess. And I guess when it's light on dark, you can really notice it. But yeah, it's dangerous. First of all, I don't know what the performance implications of it are. I know that there are performance implications when you do stuff like, the optimized legibility. On like, you know, putting that on body copy and like 1,000+ word articles can be nasty. It can really slow down rendering to a noticeable degree and even crash some Android browsers. So it's like any of these CSS-y font properties make me a little nervous. I haven't messed around with this one too much yet, but I'd be worried that, you know, you do it for your own browser. And if you're going to do it, at least open up like 50 browsers and look, you know, and see what the repercussions of it are.
I would just make sure, because, man, you can really cause a browser to just kind of choke. So optimized legibility is a really interesting one, because it can like really fix like headline display type, but then it, yeah, like it can crash browsers as well. So womp womp. That's a bummer. Anyhow, hopefully that answers your question. I was also going to say, like, I saw this Open Sans demo somebody put up or whatever, a site beautifully in this thin, crisp Open Sans, and then it just is illegible, like half letter forms on Windows and stuff like that. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
And was the point of the demo was look how beautiful this is, and it was just ironically looked bad in something
like
else.
Windows, yeah, basically. So,
oh, that's too bad.
Careful.
I was looking at Open Sans the other day. That was one of the just interesting things about it, and I wouldn't doubt that this was specifically how it was designed. But if you've ever gone into Google Web Fonts and you pick a font, and then you pick all the different weights that you'll need. I mean, sometimes you only need one weight. What if you're like, I'm only going to use this for article headlines? Maybe I only need the bold version of it. But often, if you're going to pick a font for a more widespread use on your site, the body copy or whatever, just some general thing that you're going to use all over the place, you need more than that. And I think it's pretty reasonable that you might need a bold version, an italic version, and a bold italic version. So that's four versions of the same font, and that can really, you know, they have that cheesy little meter that ratchets up how bad the performance is going to be. And a lot of them, by the time you've checked all four of those, you're way up in the red, which is responsible of Google for that. But you can, on Open Sans, you can check all four of those and you're way down in the green still. And I was like, why is that? Why is Open Sans so efficient? I think it was probably just because it was designed to be, but it's also, it's, you know, it's a sans for one thing. And so I was, you know, just pontificating about that on Twitter. And it just happens to be true, I guess, that, like, you know, you pay a serif tax in web fonts. You know, serifs are a little more complicated things that are just add to the complexity of that vector shape. You know, imagine it's just all the more points and little bits of math or whatnot that, you know, imagine a more complex SVG file, but it's just more complex on every single letter and character down the thing. So I don't know. I guess that'll be the new thing in performance land. It'll be like, what? You're using a serif font? How irresponsible of you.
You
know what I mean?
You devil. Why would you do that?
That was a while ago. I was thinking about that, but it was, I don't think we mentioned on the show. It's worth mentioning on the show, I think.
All right.
Should we do another one?
Next question comes from Tim Teeling. Again, we're scraping the bottom of the rapid fire bin. So yeah, this question's gone too, but here we go. I've been messing around with Flex Slider 2 and I wanted to pull photos from Flickr and use it as a responsive photo gallery. However, the layout breaks and has excessive white space when FlexSlider tries to account for portrait-oriented images. Is there a way to use intrinsic ratios like FitVids to get rid of the excess white space? I've tried CSS max height, but it distorts the portrait image and to fit the landscape aspect ratio. Maybe there is a way to letterbox the portrait images. So he's putting building a carousel of images, right? Or and wants to like cycle through them, but then when a portrait image happens, there's like it's super tall and that causes a bunch of white space on all the other images and stuff like that. So
yeah, that's always a classic problem, right? Because images can be any different aspect ratio, and if you want to make a photo slider that accommodates for absolutely any image width, how do you do that? And you have to ask yourself some questions about what you're okay with. If you're okay with cropping, it could be okay. Like if I want, what if the answer was, I want my photo to fill this space of an aspect ratio determined by me, let's say, you know, 16:9 or something like that. And I'm going to put this image in there and it just fill the space however you need to. That might be a possible outcome. And that, you know, in that way, you could write CSS around that. I mean, I'm not going to like mouth write CSS for you, but you can imagine what that would be like, you know, center it and put a max height and max width on stuff and that type of thing. Or you could drop it in as a background image on the div and use, you know, background size cover and position it as you were. I mean, you've dealt with this before. I feel like I've seen some code pens of yours, Dave, that were like, here's a grid, and here's an image inside that grid, and no matter what, it fits in this box.
Yeah. Yeah, I've done that. I think the way I did that is you do a max width, 100%, max height, 100%, and then the parent has a height set at some point, right? Like the figure or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And that might work for you if you're like, I want to display 100% of this image regardless of white space. Mm-hmm. And then that the height, that fixed height on the container, and we're just guessing, as I've never actually used Flex Slider here, but I'd know what – I've used 100 different image carousels in my life, I'm sure, and they're all the same, right? It's a div and it slides. Mm-hmm. So make that div a fixed height. Whatever it is, I'm sure you can control it with CSS and then use Dave's, you know, set it both a max width and a max height.
Yeah, you should be okay. And then I think you maybe do like, oh man. So you do, and then your width is auto, which is really weird. It's like the inverse of responsive where you're trying to squeeze, you know, the width, you're squeezing height. So you do max height 100% width auto instead of the inverse. It's kind of weird. Think about that.
That is tricksy.
But I would assume this is kind of a solved problem for the carousel world. So somebody's probably worked on this at some point. That's all.
Those are fun. That's a fun little CSS problem. Oh. You know, like I have unknown content and I want my layout to work no matter what is kind of a
well, that's like a fun CSS you have to problem. Do that for like WordPress themes, you know, like. You have to handle any kind of content ever that happens. So anyway, hopefully that works. Hopefully that helps. Or if you found a better solution by now in the last 10 years since you asked that question, hit us up. That sounds good.
Yeah, I don't know. I put these in here because they're like, these are probably the questions that me and you are probably best.
I know.
Maybe not best suited, but like, you know, it's hard to for our guests to be like, hey, do you want to troubleshoot some obnoxious CSS problem with us?
No, I'm down. This is great. Here we go. Shall we do? Should we do a sponsor here?
Oh, sure. I'd love to. So lynda.com is one of our sponsors, lynda.com. Huge learning resource on the web. We've talked about it a number of times. You know the kind of stuff that's on there. There's stuff about creating icon fonts for the web. There's like courses, all kinds of WordPress on different CMSs, WordPress, Drupal, Joomla. It's all on there if you need to level up in those abilities. They have all kinds of web stuff. In fact, they probably have mostly that type of stuff. But they also have tons of design stuff. Do you want to just be a better designer? They got stuff on there. They got tips on shooting with new cameras that come out. You can get better at photography on lynda.com. They have, you know, level up your ability to use Google Analytics with cool stuff that's in there. They have apps for your mobile devices. So if you want to, like, for example, you could like go on the web and just bum around lynda.com and be like, this looks good, this looks good, this looks like, and build a playlist. Then that playlist syncs with your mobile device. So when you're just like bored on the bus or something, you can just open up your Lynda app and start watching that video. I was just talking about the other day about how that's often how I like to watch online video training content is passively like that. I'm not like Googling a programming question on Lynda and then sitting there and working with that project to solve my immediate programming problem. I mostly watch it like I'm going to like level up passively so I can learn this stuff so that my brain knows when to reach for it later. So there's over 2,500 courses on there, and the courses are full of videos. So you just can imagine how ridiculously vast the library is on lynda.com. Pretty cool stuff. Thank you for sponsoring. What do you got, Dave?
All right, let's do another question here from the question box. Here we go. Brian writes in, you know how for a long time we've been supposed to make an H1 for a banner of our site and then use to put text in there and then text indent by 9999 pics and then have a background image there for the banner. It seems like responsive web design is becoming acceptable to use foreground images in the markup as banner images so that they can be scaled down to narrow viewports. Is this acceptable now? What's the word? What's the deal? I look forward to hearing your fresh non-dogmatic take on this. Here we go. Non-dogma, go. You got an opinion, Chris?
Yeah, kind of. So, like, Brian is talking about if you did, like, logo.png back in the day, we used to go, like, H1 with the text logo in it and then kick that off the page. And there's a number of different ways that you can do that. You can use, like, the clip thing in CSS, or you could text indent 100% with overflow hidden so it kicks it off. Or a very common one was to text indent -9999 so it's way off the page to the left and overflow hidden that. And whatever. There's all these different ways to do it. But Brian's saying, I've seen more and more people just say, screw that. Image source equals logo.png, whatever. Alt tag logo. And then you could even put that in an H1 if you want. And the question is, nobody ever really knew the answer to this. It's endlessly debated. Nobody knows exactly what kind of penalty you get for that, or does Google care at all, or whatever. But Brian's also noticing that if I do put it as an IMG tag, then it's way easier to scale. I can just set the width of it, right? Where it's a little more difficult to do that when it's a background image in CSS. But it's not really that hard in CSS because you can set background size 100%. So if the div that you put it in or whatever is of a fluid size and the background size is 100% in the direction that you're trying to scale it, it can scale as well. So I think it's a horse apiece. I don't think it matters all that much.
Well, in media queries, and background size have like parity. They're based, except for probably Opera Mini or whatever, they're like the same browser set, you know? So that's
a good point, is that responsive images is not a difficult problem in CSS. So if you have a mega high quality 2x logo or whatever, you can handle specifying different logo images. And these don't have to be logos, this could be anything.
Yeah.
And it's easier to flop them out with media queries. So
I would just use, just use an image with an alt tag, call it a day. And if somebody comes along and is like, we're going to make 100 more SEO points by using a background image, just be like, yeah, sure. Okay.
Hey, let's talk about something interesting.
I think spriting is the big one, cause that was a big deal, hopefully if you have to sprite or you want to sprite, then text indent or clip.
And I hope that your logo needs to not.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, right. Yeah. I just hope your logo doesn't need, should be, if I just think of most logos as being pretty SVG friendly. Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, that's what it should actually be.
Yeah, just do that. All right. Hold on. It's been a while since I've heard a... All right, next question.
Mike Torosian asks, if you use media queries to adjust the body font size percentage, is there any rule to figuring out the adjustments to the percentage as you go along? So I think what Mike is asking is, let's say you set body font size 100%.
100%.
Perfectly fine thing to do. You might say, at a mobile, I'm going to bump that down a little bit. And you, let's say in your particular design, you decide mobile is maybe you do it the other way around. Well, let's just do a max width one. I know that's not mobile first or whatever. But you say at media max width equals 400 pixels. So now the code in that media query is only for browsers, windows who have a maximum width of 400 pixels. You might say body font size 90%. Mm-hmm. You're like, why would you go down? I don't know. Yeah, you go down a little bit generally on mobile just because you generally hold the thing closer to your face and they have whatever. It's just the case. Generally, what looks good on a desktop browser a little bit smaller than that for body copy tends to look good on mobile, at least in my experience. So Mike's asking, how do you decide what that is?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
So how do it takes you a little bit of math, So in the old days, browsers used to set whatever font size they want, but now they all more or less do 16 pixels unless the user has changed that, right? So if the user has changed that, you want it to be 100% so it can like continue to scale or whatever. So the rule is like just assume it's 16 pixels as a default and then do your math from there. So whatever 92.5 would be 15 pixels, 87.5 would be
what you're saying, yeah.
87.5% would be 14 pixels, stuff like that. So, and that's just like that responsive web design math. You do target divided by context equals 0.87, you know, 14 divided by 16 equals 0.875 times 100 equals 875.
Or you could just bump down the percentage and just see how it looks.
Yep.
And if,
exactly. If like play it super loose, you know, don't care less. Well, that's a good message. Huh?
I just published an article about what I was thinking of an interesting idea of setting a root font size, then setting all of your actual text elements like H1s and Ps and LIs and DDs and TDs and anything that could have text in them, raw text nodes right in them, or generally are straight up for text. Set all of that in Ms. But then anything that a container that they're going to be inside, set in rem, so that they have a one, you know, a ratio directly to the root. So that way you can bump up the whole document and everything scales all together. So it could be 100% on the, or there could be a media query for mobile that goes down to 90%. And everything scales down with it. But if you're like, oh, that wasn't quite right, the footer is now a little bit too small, which I found to be in practice a fairly common scenario. That way you can target just the footer and bump its rem size up just a little bit and you're good to go. So you have this kind of global control that's going to deal with most stuff for you, but you have component level control as well. And some people were mad at me right away. They were just like, you shouldn't set pics at the root because that overrides the user setting. And they're probably right about that, but there's nothing to say that you couldn't use percentage up there instead. So that way you're kind of getting the best of both worlds. I should probably update that article, but whatever.
Easy fix. So yeah, hopefully that helps you, Mike. Yeah, I think we answered his question, huh?
Yeah. Should we do one from the sidebar here?
Yeah, let's rapid fire this sidebar. Does that sound good?
Yeah, do it. Super quick
Vince
one.
Spielman writes in, what do you guys use for style guide generation? KSS, Sassdown, Assemble, Atomic, Hologram. I love Sassdown, but it's grunt only. Any thoughts? Do you use any?
I've never used any of those. Generators? I've heard of good things about KSS, though. No, I've like KSS I said, I've used KSS good. Only briefly, and
Assemble looks good. I like Brad Frost's Pattern Lab. I mean, just like, but that's not like automatic style guide generation. So it's tough. I don't know that I've seen a solution that like meets my needs explicitly. So, but I'm always on the
I've always gotten a kick out of just making them. Just make one, you know, just like handcraft that baby for you. I don't know. Not to say that you shouldn't automate stuff, but that's what I've always done in the past. Be like, here's an example of what this is like. Here you go.
I think there's a big kind of stress point where you want your production environment to be totally up to date to your style guide. So you want this like automatic generation kind of thing. It's hard, but I think it's possible in the long run. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, that's all.
I'm going to do one more conference for one more sponsor here just so we get them out of the way. There's Artifact Conf coming up. That's the URL for it. It's artifactconf.com. It's a two-day single-track conference, and it's all about – here's what it says. Artifact is an intimate two-day single-track conference that helps web designers and developers adapt their tools and processes to the challenges of designing for a multi-device world. Man, have we talked about anything else the last couple of years? If so, scarcely, right? It's all about designing in a multi-device world these days. It's coming up May 5th through 7th in Austin, Texas. Mr. Dave will be there.
Hey.
Yep. Are the people the same at both two events? Is that how they tried to go it? Or are the people listed on the website right now just for the Austin one and then it will change?
I think it's just Austin right now, but I think they try to kind of bring like it's almost like a road show that they try to like take across America and the world.
So if you can't make it to Austin, it is coming to Providence, Rhode Island in September, September 29th and October 1st. So that should be pretty cool. You can use Shop Talk Show for $100 off it, which is, you know, a good deal. Cool. Can you confirm we'll pick this Michael Schofield question. Can you confirm the reason because your cameras aren't turned on is because you're both not wearing pants? I happen to have pants good on right question. Now. I'm pretty open about the idea of sharing when my pants are off, and they just happen to be on at the moment. But it's just because I had to go to my tax guy today, and I just feel like I still do the pants thing in public. You know, I don't think I've earned the right really to do public de-pantsing.
I too am wearing pants. It's a big part of my day. These pants had an interesting thing where I realized I ran out of pants. All my jeans got kind of blown out. So had to go buy pants recently. Enjoying it. Thank you for your question.
Good story. Are there, Eric Katz asks, any thoughts on the Condoleezza Rice Plus Dropbox thing? I saw this just before, and this will be old news by the time you're listening to this, because this actually isn't going to air on the show for like 2 more weeks, and I'm sure all this drama will have blown over, but apparently she's going to be on their board or something. And I saw one website of people that are very mad because she like started a war and there's problems with that. And I don't mean to brush this over because it's, I'm sure, a very serious issue. But to be perfectly honest, my drama threshold for the day is just about exceeded.
I would agree. If it's still around the next time we do a live show, I'm sure we'll talk about it. But yeah, my hashtag activism meter is at full, so thank you for playing.
We'll talk about it for real when there's a little more to talk about, I think.
Yeah, wait for a response.
I'll read one from the queue here. Sure. David Barra asks, do you know of any good JavaScript techniques to create PDF files? For example, after rendering an invoice or some other page with HTML and CSS, imagine something that like Harvest or FreshBooks does or something, to create a PDF of that on the fly with just JavaScript. So David apparently doesn't want to hit the server with that request. He's hoping to kind of client-side generate a PDF file to save, which sounds reasonable-ish to me. Have you ever heard anything like that, Dave?
You know, I've never done anything. I assume there's like a JavaScript PDF library or something like that, but that sounds kind of crazy and you'd need like file system access probably, right? So that's not always a given.
Well, I don't know.
Maybe not. I don't know.
Well, not to trigger a save, I don't think, because you can kind of save a, have you ever seen a demo where you can like save Canvas as an image?
Yeah,
I don't know,
yeah.
There's some kind of way for it to do that. It makes a file on the fly with, so I think there's some HTML5 stuff involved. I think that might be what's going on here. I wonder if you could write HTML stuff to maybe to SVG and then to Canvas, or maybe just write to Canvas and then have the Canvas make an image out of it and then the image goes, or maybe there's even a better way to do it. Just in Googling it really quick, I found JS PDF. So
it looks pretty good.
There is some kind of library to do it. Looks, yeah, actually, this has gotten better. I think I Googled this a while ago on the webpage, actually. This is, looks like pretty nice, yeah.
Does font face too, apparently? That's good. That's what you want.
Because you don't really want it to be an image. That would be janky, right? You want it to be a PDF because then it's still like selectable and prints nicely and searchable and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. It looks like there is a way to do it, and JS PDF looks like it'll do it. I can't personally vouch for it because I haven't used it, but the webpage looks nice. Actually, wow, there's a like live demo on here. It works super well. Okay, yeah. Well, that's the way to do it then. Next.
Hey, boom. Next question going from the page that we've been working on. Why SCSS over less? I use less for my framework Thumper. This is from Robert DeLuca. He's got a framework called Thumper. Why SCSS over less? I use less for my framework, and I'm curious why SCSS is chosen over less. Less,
I don't know.
Is that
more, still true?
I heard.
It probably is more. I don't know. It's one of these questions where I feel like in my world, I see so much more SaaS than I see less stuff. But is that a manifestation of just who I am and what I tend to click on and read and think about and write about and stuff? Or is that indicative of a global trend of web design that SaaS is more popular?
I you know,
it's hard to even think.
Yeah, I mean, is SaaS more popular? Like Bootstrap is the most popular thing in the world, and it uses less. So less is great. I think a lot of people use less. I like SaaS. I like SaaS's syntax. I like that it's super exactly like CSS. It's like how I would write a CSS pre-processing framework for the most part. So that's why I like SCSS personally.
Yeah. I mean, I did a, you know, this just feels like an old thing to me because I have an old article that kind of pits them head to head. And that's like, I don't know. I'm glad people still find that. Every once in a while I revisit it and I'm like, yeah, this all sounds real, pretty true, right? Like the idea that like every single class name you write and less can be extended is a little weird. But then I'm like, I don't know, maybe that's kind of nice. At least it's easy to understand at first. And now less has extends too. That used to be a major strike against less, but now it has it. And I actually kind of like how it works a little bit better because you can choose like how deep down the nesting trail you want to go with your extend. Whereas SCSS, it extends absolutely everything within the nest right away. And that's why people are always like, be really careful with extend. It can get gross. I'm sure you've heard that sentiment before. Less doesn't do that. It extends just the base level of the extend by default, or optionally you can have it extend all the way down or just two levels down or whatever. So it's like, I don't know. It seems a little bit more powerful actually in how extend works. I don't know, math and stuff. I like how there's built-in actual looping in SAS is kind of a big deal to me. I use that pretty regularly actually. And SAS maps is really cool. And like, unless if you want to write a loop, it's like, it's kind of tough. You have to write like a mix in that kind of references itself and, but make sure to change some variables so that you can check if the variable is a certain thing before you like stop the loop and stuff. It seems a little strange to me. You know, it's nice to just know that there's kind of normal programming features within the language that you pick, which there is.
Well, when
SAS, like less- if then and all that stuff.
When Less launched, it had that like feature where you could use JavaScript to compile it like on the fly or whatever. And that they no one really advocates that and stuff like that. So that's like skip over that like as a knock. But that's kind of really important to think about when you're marketing a framework. Like, is anyone going to disagree with this sort of thing? Or is this actually kind of bad? Yeah. And so... maybe I shouldn't market that feature, but just have it on my local box. I don't know. All right. Next question. Let's do one from Near Benita. What do you guys think about the difference between self-taught web designer and a designer with a degree, let's say computer science? Chris, you got an opinion?
Yeah, it's interesting because there's advantages on both sides. You'd think the self-taught web designer has some advantages actually, because to me that the word self-taught web designer means, oh wow, you are so internally motivated that you sought out this career and you got good at it theoretically, and that's what you have this internal drive for it. Whereas somebody with just a degree in computer science, I don't automatically know that about you. Maybe you do have an internal drive that drives you, but maybe not. Maybe you just, you know, went to college and you picked some kind of thing and you bumbled your way through it or whatever. That's fine. But there's something to be said for somebody who's just like, you know, I am who I am because I got here on my own volition. And that's nice. But then there's the like, oh, I'm a little jealous of your degree, actually, because you were forced to learn some hard concepts that maybe I didn't bother to learn on my own because I just wasn't comfortable with it. You know, hardcore computer science stuff. May not be the thing that you choose to learn when you're just self-taught. Anyway, wishy-washy answer. What do you think, Dave?
That's a good question. I mean, self-taught seems very strong. Let's say a degree, you know, that seems very like they worked real hard, got through 4 years of college. But was it one of those colleges where you just pay to get your way through? That's tough. I mean, I think it would depend on the college, to be honest. But I would maybe say, just without knowing anyone, that the person with the degree probably has a few more social skills, because I know they were forced to interact with people in a classroom. That's all I'm going to say. Is that fair?
That's fair. It's a little easier to buy LSD in college than it is self-taught.
Yeah. I mean, you don't know. You don't even have like a, what is it called? RA, a resident advisor who can be your friend. if you're self-taught.
Yeah, you don't have that. You don't have that. Or when you're seeing crazy stuff in the hallway.
Yeah.
So your RA is not there for you.
Yep. That's, yep. You're going to end up in a ditch if you do it yourself. There you go. Okay, let's do one more.
We'll do one from the sidebar. Josh Bella asks, what are your thoughts on working on for clients versus working on products, challenges, rewards, etc.? I'm experienced front-end developer contemplating my next move, and I'm interested in your insights on the matter. I love this question because I think it's not even talked about enough in this world, and that I think it feels a lot differently. Oh, you little squirts. What it's like digging into one project and working on one thing day after day after day than it is working on a new project all the time. And we're different in that way because you largely do client work and I largely do product work. So I don't know. It doesn't mean that we can't have a conversation, certainly, but it does. It's different anyway.
Yeah. I mean, client work is, you know, it's new every time, right? You engage and you talk with somebody, you figure out their business and or try to, and then you try to convey that, you know, over and over and over and over. And that can be kind of exhausting for a lot of people. That's where like the steady, I guess it's not guaranteed steady pace of working on a product, but at least like you're kind of like pouring your effort into one bucket and you're hopeful that that bucket becomes more and more successful or that your efforts paid off. I think that's kind of the risk versus reward, I guess, is, you know, you're kind of with the product, like say CodePen or something like that, you're putting all your eggs kind of in one basket, even though I know you're not doing that, Chris, but with like a client thing, you're like, I'm going to have 100 baskets and each of them will pay me just a little bit. And
so you're saying that the risk of failure is higher with the product? I can see that.
It seems like it could be, but the risk of burnout on.
I feel like the end game then is weird though, because like if you failure on both sides is failure, right? If you just didn't cut it as a client person, then you're left with nothing, and if your product didn't go anywhere, you're left with nothing essentially too. Surely there's some byproducts and learning and all that stuff that goes involved, but you're at the same place either way. Whereas with client work, if everything goes perfectly well at the way end of all your, you know, when you're you don't have any sustainable thing left. You know, I don't know. Not that I'm trying to discourage anybody from client work. It can be, I'm sure, very rewarding, but that's what worries me a little bit about it, is that you don't have this like sustainable finished thing when you're done, right? Like you're done with your last client and income is over.
Yeah, pretty much. Like the well can run dry, basically. That's risky. That's a challenge. So you have to actively like secure new work over and over. I always liken it to like you making client services is like mowing lawns. Like basically you have to like get out there and do it every week or whatever. Or if it's your business, you have to go out and find more people to mow lawns and then hire mm-hmm. more people so you can mow more lawns and stuff like that. But a product is a little bit like, I don't know, you invented a yard mowing robot and you just need to sell that to people. A lawn.
It's just Roomba. Exactly like that, right?
Yeah.
And there's a threshold, because if you don't sell enough lawn Roombas, that sucks. You didn't do it. I think you need to ask yourself what you're motivated by. I know through experience and working in both that I really prefer being able to long-term think about one project and really like have time to poke around on it and improve it incrementally and work on it. It just fits my personality a little better. But I know plenty of people that are activated and challenged and love there being something new all the time. And I can see that, and I am occasionally jealous of that. Like, oh man, you got this cool new client you're such a good designer. You were able to like understand what they needed and you just knocked it out of the park. And that's so awesome. I don't have the opportunity to do that very often, you know? So, I can tell that your ideas and work were motivated by the cool work they're doing. Whereas I don't get that external energy, I guess.
Yeah. 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 I think it depends on personality a lot. So, good luck, John. Hopefully that helps you out in your searches. Want to do one more?
Doctor.
All right. Let's do Tyler Sargent writes in. Do you have any resources or suggestion for easing the confusion caused when using CodeKit and MAMP to work locally on a WordPress build? Things have started to get messy for me when I bring in SAS, Bourbon, Neat, etc. So CodeKit and MAMP locally, WordPress. Do you have any tips for that?
Yeah, I don't know. You'd have to say exactly why that's confusing, I guess, because it seems somewhat straightforward to me, right? MAMP, you get a URL with MAMP and you get a database and stuff. So it's just MAMP all by itself, I would set up first, and then, or something else. There's MAMP competitors these days and stuff. What you need is a local development URL, essentially, that runs PHP for you and runs Apache for you, runs MySQL for you, so that you can open your site at a URL and on your local computer and get that all working. And then once that's working, then CodeKit gets involved. And in CodeKit 2.0, you drop your folder on there, and then you say, well, because this is CodeKit has its own server, and if it only works for the most basic stuff, if it's a site that you need MAMP for because you need all those other things like MySQL and PHP, you just say, okay, CodeKit, use your server, but just go get the stuff from this URL that I'm about to give it. So let's say you literally set up like mywebsite.dev, you just put mywebsite.dev right in CodeKit, and then they work together pretty well. So I could see that might be a little confusing, but there's docs for that stuff and you can get it set up. And then once you've conquered it, it should hopefully kind of stop being confusing. You know, it should just be set up that way forever, ideally. And then he says, things have started to get messy for me when I bring in SAS, Bourbon, Neat, etc. So I guess we just have to know a little bit more about what that messiness feels like and what the errors look like and stuff.
Yeah, that's
can figure out what he means.
Well, I mean, CodeKit compiles SAS. MAMP serves websites. So, CodeKit compiles SAS into CSS. MAMP serves websites. Your website has a server remotely. I would just focus on handing up the theme with compiled CSS to the target server. I think that's kind of what all you need to do there. Hopefully that's kind of what you're getting at. But all these dependencies like SAS and Bourbon and Neat, or like Bourbon Neat or whatever, that's like a SAS plugin. I mean, you'll just have to include those and kind of manage those with some sort of file. I don't know. There's probably like a dependency file.
Maybe I am starting to understand it a little more, because Bourbon and Neat though come with CodeKit. So if you want to add Bourbon to a project, you can do that directly through CodeKit. But what if you wanted to add like a Compass plugin that wasn't bundled with CodeKit? Where would you do that in CodeKit land? I'm actually not sure at that point, because those are like, they're like command line install-y things, you know, like sometimes they, you know, like I'm not even sure how all that stuff works. So I could see how that's confusing. I actually don't really have a good answer for that.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, Suzy, for example, right? Everybody, that's such a cool framework. How do you use Suzy with CodeKit? I have no idea.
Yeah, I guess you'd have to like totally have some sort of gem file thing that does a thing and...
It's just a folder full of stuff you can drop in your project and reference. I mean, if that's the case, okay, but I'm not sure that it is.
I think Bourbon works that way, but not I've done that actually, but not Suzy or Singularity and stuff like that. I think those are all gems you have to install. So Tyler, write it out, send us in a big question and we'll try it even more.
We are not exactly knocking it out of the park this show. Sorry, hey. Folks. It's Friday afternoon.
Friday. I've had a orange San Pellegrino. It's delicious, guys and girls. Appreciate it.
Not a sponsor.
Yeah. Chubbug, brought to you by San Pellegrino water, flavored water for your mouth. All right. On that bombshell, I think we should probably wrap it up. Thank you, everyone, for listening and struggling through this. We didn't get to all the questions in the sidebar. If we did not answer your question, please send it in. We really appreciate it. And yeah, this is fun to try out. Google Hangouts is a hit and miss sort of scenario. So anyway, we really appreciate that. Vote us up in your podcatcher of choice. And Chris, you have anything left?
ShopTalkShow.com.